This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This podcast is brought to you by Joy sponsor Pam Ann.
Hello, Melbourne. It's Pam Ann here. I'm so excited. I'm going to be touching down at the Comedy Theatre in August. See you soon. I love you, Melbourne. Mwah.
Set to land in Melbourne this August for two hilarious shows, Friday, August 24 and Saturday, August 25. Get your tickets now at ticketmaster.com.au.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
In last night's episode of The Informer, we heard from Dr. Damien Riggs, Associate Professor in Social Work at Flinders University and Project Leader in the Research into Fertility Preservation among Trans and Non-Binary Australians. We reported on their initial findings, which created a snapshot of the information sourced by the study with over 400 Australians surveyed.
With the summation details opening up a plethora of information data that can be shared on a range of topics relating to the study for trans and non-binary individuals, we began to discuss how they sought such a rich and diverse engagement through the study. The blueprint of this is a great way for people creating data and research in the non-binary, transgender and gender diverse field.
So we continue our conversation tonight with Dr. Damien Riggs, a psychotherapist who works with transgender adolescents and children, as we discuss his experiences engaging with these individuals on fertility options, experiences and concerns.
In addition to working at Flinders, I'm a psychotherapist and I work with transgender kids. And so part of the conversations I have with children as they approach puberty and may wish to start puberty blockers is about fertility preservation. And it's an unusual conversation to have because you don't normally talk to very young children about do you want to have kids when you grow up, but it's part of what we need to do to make sure they have that option. And so it's always been on my radar, and then presenting at different conferences around this topic and sort of questioning, you know, how many people are actually doing it? We don't really know in Australia. We've got a little bit of international research. What does it look like in Australia? So that sort of led us to do this project. I think it is like a historical consequence that historically trans people were expected to undergo a range of surgeries that would mean they could no longer conceive children from their own gamete. And that was the norm. That was what was expected. And there was no choice around that. And I think as that has shifted, as, you know, and certainly only in the last decade, the possibility of storing gametes has been more widely available to trans people in Australia. But then people need to know that's available to ask for that service, unless they happen to work with a really inclusive service provider who says, oh, this is something you might like to think about. And that was, in a way, one of my entry points to this study, was knowing that as a clinician, I need to talk to young people about this, and I absolutely do that and believe in that. But worrying or wondering about what it means to say to a very young person before they start puberty blockers, do you want to store gametes, or for people who haven't started puberty, tissue, and in the possibility you might want kids in the future. And lots of people will say yes because you're offering a possibility, and who knows what you want in the future. But my worry is about the cost. It costs a lot of money to do this. It's invasive, particularly for trans boys and for trans men. There's annual storage fees. And then, of course, we know that the longer you freeze gametes, the less likely they are to thaw successfully. So I'm, you know, always been careful about that this is a possibility you could undertake, but there's no promise that even something will come of it, even if you decide you want to. So that was my initial entry point, actually, into this project, was wanting to know how many people are wanting to do this so that we can make sure people are informed about the decisions they're making down the track.
While discussing the initial findings of their research into fertility preservation decision-making amongst trans and non-binary Australians, it seemed clear that for Dr. Damien Riggs, co-lead researcher of this study at Flinders University, this was not just about understanding the number of individuals who had engaged with fertility preservation information and services, but also to identify the ways in which individuals had been limited in their access. I asked Dr. Riggs if it appeared that the majority had been made aware of these options available to them, specifically by medical and fertility professionals.
That was something that we were really, I guess, in a way surprised by. Not that we thought everyone would know it was an option, but, you know, as a clinician myself, and I work according to the WPATH standards, which say we need to advise people this is an option, we need to create those pathways. I think I just thought that most people would have come in contact because of the way gender transition is regulated in this country through medical professionals and mental health professionals, that people would have been exposed to this information. But I think partly it's probably a lack of professionals providing that information, and partly it's people saying, I don't want to be part of that system. I'm going to negotiate my own ways through gender transition, which may or may not involve hormones, may or may not involve surgery. And therefore, if you're not coming into contact with those professionals, you're not going to get the information. So that, I think, reflects a lot of research on not primarily on the lives of transgender people around having kids, that we tend to see much lower rates of trans people having kids than we would expect from a population average. And there's lots of reasons around that. People prioritise transition over having children, which is totally reasonable. People don't see children as part of their life. They have other areas that they focus on in their life. No one's really looked into, actually, why people are less likely to have kids if they're trans or non-binary, but it's a common research finding that far fewer people do have children. So we had about a third of participants were men and about a third of participants were non-binary, and then the rest was distributed between mainly women and then a small number of agender people. So we had a decent spread of diversity across our sample. Something I'll have to think about when we go back and write this second paper from the data is maybe look at, for people who had said they wish they had or would have liked that to have been an option, was there reasoning around cost? Because we don't really have that data, and I don't think we really have that data internationally. We have data that says the cost is prohibitive, but we don't necessarily know whether people would have done it even if the cost wasn't prohibitive. So we're sort of operating on what seems to be the case, that lower numbers of people are wanting to do this than you would expect from the general population. But maybe cost is a really key factor in the whole thing.
I also discussed with Dr. Riggs what, beyond the issue of cost and interest in biological children, could be done to improve the experiences and outcomes for trans and non-binary Australians to engage with fertility services and options going forward.
I think there's a knowledge, perhaps, limitation, and we're going to do another separate different study later, this year, that's part of an international study. And part of that, it's primarily on trans men and reproduction, but we're also going to talk to reproductive health professionals. And what do they know about working with trans people in reproductive areas? What do they understand? What kind of inclusion do they offer? What kind of language do they use? So I think certainly the clinical capacity there is in terms of, you know, the practices, the techniques, but whether people would go along to those services and feel welcomed and feel included, that's another question. I think it's an interesting topic, and people know that this kind of question hasn't really been asked before in Australia. I think it's also around the idea, having, you know, spent almost a decade now doing research with trans people on trans people's experiences, it is a slow burn, I think, and it should be a slow burn, because we have to prove we can be trusted if we're not transgender, and I'm not. We have to show that the research we do is fair and reasonable and inclusive. It doesn't contribute to anti-trans and anti-non-binary sentiment. And I think it takes time to trust people. And I think, you know, researchers and clinicians have done a lot of crappy things to trans and non-binary communities in the past and still in the present. And so I think it's really reasonable that over time we have built up trust as a research team, and that our research is seen as useful and trustworthy. And I think that's certainly our agenda, is to keep building that trust and to keep researching topics that people tell us are interesting and that they want to know more about, and not be led by random ideas we might have what could be a useful topic. There's absolutely three prongs to it to us. There's one is community information, so that people know this is an option. There's one is about educating professionals so that they're aware of barriers. And the third is about, under the current WPATH standards, we're encouraged to suggest this to people, give people advice, but it's a very brief couple of pages in a very long document. There's a new version hopefully coming out in the next year or so. Hopefully this will also inform that around how do we have these conversations, rather than just you should have the conversations with clients. How do we talk about it? Do we use a desire for genetic relatedness to be a way we have the conversation? Do we acknowledge that non-binary people have very specific experiences and needs? So it's also about informing that clinical work as well.
That was Tom Morgan with Dr. Damien Riggs.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.